my mind. What if that huddled shape beneath the blankets were not one body, but two? An arm flung back a coverlet to reveal only one form occupying the great bed. He rolled to face me and then sat up. Concern furrowed his brow. "Fitz, are you hurt?" I sat down heavily on the edge of his bed, set one hand to each side of my head and pushed, trying to hold my skull together. "No. Yes. It's the skill, but we haven't time for that. I know where the prince is. I dreamed him. He was night-hunting with the cat in the hills behind Gallatin. Then something was hunting us, and the cat went up one tree, and I, the prince, went up another. And then he looked down, and he saw Night-Eyes under the tree. The wolf has him treed somewhere in those hills. If we go now, we can take him." "No, we can't. Use your common sense." "I can't. My head is cracking like an eggshell." I hunched forwards, elbows on my knees, head in my hands. "Why can't we go get him?" I asked piteously.
"Walk your thoughts through it, my friend. We dress and creep out of this room, get past the stable folk to take our horses out, ride through unfamiliar country by night until we come to where the prince is up a tree with a wolf at the foot of it. One of us climbs the tree and forces the prince down. Then we coax him to come back with us. Lord Golden miraculously appears at breakfast with, I imagine, a very disgruntled Prince Dutiful. Or Lord Golden and his man simply disappear from Lady Brisinga's hospitality without a word of explanation. In any case, in a few days, a lot of very uncomfortable questions are going to be asked about Lord Golden and his man Tom Badgerlock, not to mention Prince Dutiful."
He was right. We already suspected the Brisingas were involved in the prince's disappearance. Bringing him back to Galekeep would be foolish. We had to recover him in such a way that we could take him straight back to Buckkeep and no one the wiser. I pressed my fingers to my eyeballs. It felt as if the pressure inside my skull would force them out of their sockets. "What do we do, then?" I asked thickly. I didn't even really want to know. I wanted to fall on my side and huddle into a miserable ball.
"The wolf keeps track of the prince. Tomorrow, during our hunt, I will send you back for something I've forgotten. Once you are on your own, you will go to where the prince is and persuade him to return to Buckkeep. I chose you a big horse. Take him with you immediately and return him to Buckkeep. I'll find a way to explain your absence."
"How?"
"I haven't thought of it yet, but I will. Don't be concerned about it. Whatever tale I tell, the Brisingas will have to accept for risk of offending me."
I picked at the next largest hole in the plan. It was hard to keep my thoughts in order.
"I persuade him to come back to Buckkeep."
"You can do it," the fool replied with great confidence.
"You will know what to say."
I doubted it, but had run out of strength to object. There were painfully bright lights behind my closed eyes. Knuckling them made them worse. I opened my eyes to the dim room, but zigzags of light still danced before my vision, sharding it.
"Elfbark," I pleaded quietly. "I need it."
"No." My mind could not encompass that he had refused me.
"Please," I pushed the word out. "The pain is worse than I can explain."
Sometimes I could tell when a seizure was coming on. I hadn't had one in a long time. Was I imagining that odd tension in my neck and back?
"Fitz, I can't. Chade made me promise."
In a lower voice, as if he feared it was too little to offer, he added,
"I'll be here with you."
Pain tumbled me in a wave. Fear mingled with it. "Should I come?"
"No, stay where you are. Watch him."
I heard myself say the words out loud as I thought them. There was something I was supposed to worry about in that. I recalled it.
"I need elfbark tea," I managed to say, "or I can't hold the limits. On the wit, they'll know I'm here."
The bed moved under me as the fool clambered out of it, a terrible jostling that pounded my brain against the inside of my skull. I heard him go to the washstand. A moment later he was back, damp cloth in hand.
"Lie back," he told me.
"Can't," I muttered. Any movement hurt. I wanted to get back to my own room, but could not. If I was going to have a fit, I didn't want to do it in front of the fool. The cold cloth on my brow was like a shock. I retched with it, then took short panting breaths to get my stomach under control. I more felt than saw the fool crouch down before me as I sat on the edge of the bed. He took my hand in gloved ones, and his fingers fumbled over mine. An instant later, they bit down, pinching hard between the bones of my hand. I gave an inarticulate cry and tried to pull free of him, but as ever he was stronger than I expected. "Just for a moment," he muttered, as if reassuring me. The pain in my hand became a racing numbness. A moment later, he seized my arm just above my elbow in both his hands, and again his fingers sought and then pinched down hard. "Please," I begged him, and tried to move away from him. He moved with me, and the pain in my head was such I couldn't escape. Why was he hurting me? "Don't struggle," he begged me. "Trust me. I think I can help. Trust me." Again his hands moved, this time to my shoulder, and again those relentless fingers jabbed down hard. I gasped, and then his hands were on either side of my neck, his fingers pressing in and up as if he wished to detach my head. I grasped his wrists, but could find no strength in my hands. "A moment," he begged me again. "Fitz, Fitz, trust me, trust me." Then something went out of me. My head dropped forwards on my chest, lolling on my neck. The pain was not gone, but it was much diminished. I fell over on my side, and he rolled me onto my back. "There, there," he said, and for a moment I stared into blessed darkness. Then the gloved hands were back, thumbs on my brow, spread fingertips seeking spots on my temples and the sides of my face, and then they pressed mercilessly, his smallest fingers digging in at the hinge of my jaw. "Take a breath, Fitz," I heard him tell me, and then I realized that I was not breathing. I gasped for air, and everything suddenly eased. I wanted to weep for relief. Instead, I sank instantly into a bottomless sleep. I dreamed a strange dream. I dreamed I was safe. I came to a hazy wakefulness before dawn. I took a deep breath and realized I was in the fool's bed. I think he had just arisen. He was moving quietly about the room, selecting clothing for himself. I think he felt me watching him, for he came back to the bedside. He touched my brow, pushing my head back onto the pillow. "Go back to sleep. You have a little more time to rest, and I think you need it." Two gloved fingers traced twin lines from the top of my head to the bridge of my nose. I slept again. When next I woke, it was because he was gently shaking me. My servant blue clothing was laid out on the bed beside me. He was already fully dressed. "Time to hunt," he told me when he saw I was awake. "I'm afraid you'll have to hurry." I moved my head cautiously. I ached all along my spine and neck. I sat up stiffly. I felt as if I had been in a fist fight or had a seizure. There was a sore spot inside my cheek as if I'd bitten it. I looked away from him as I asked, "Did I have a fit last night?" A small silence preceded his words. He kept his voice casual. "A small one, perhaps. You tossed your head about and trembled for a time in your sleep. I held you still. It passed." He did not want to speak of it any more than I did. I dressed slowly. My whole body ached. My left arm bore the marks of the fool's fingers, small, dark circles of bruising, so I had not imagined the strength of his grip. He saw me inspecting my arm and winced sympathetically. "It leaves bruises, but sometimes it seems to work," was all he offered by way of explanation. Hunt mornings at Galekeep were very similar to hunt mornings at Buckkeep Castle. Suppressed excitement tingled in the air. Breakfast was a hurried affair, taken standing in the courtyard, and the painstaking efforts of the kitchen folk were scarcely noticed. I had only a mug of beer, for I dared face no more than that. I did, however, have the foresight to do as Laurel had noted, and store some food in my saddle pack and make sure my water skin was freshly filled. I glimpsed Laurel in the hubbub of folk, but she was very busy, talking to at least four people at once. Lord Golden strolled through the crowd, greeting each person with a warm smile. Lord Grayling's daughter was always at his elbow. Siddle's smile and chatter were constant, and Lord Golden replied with attentive courtesy. Did young Civil look a bit irritated with that? The horses were brought, saddled and gleaming from the stables. My black seemed unimpressed with the excitement in the air, and again I wondered at her seeming lack of spirit. The gathering seemed oddly muted to me, and then I smiled to myself. There was no excited baying to lift the heart and infect the horses with excitement. I missed hounds. The hunters and their attendants mounted, and then the cats were brought forth on their leads. The cats were sleek, short-coated creatures with elongated bodies. Their heads appeared small to me at first glance. Their coats were tawny, but in certain angles of the light, subdued dappling could be distinguished. Each cat's long, graceful tail seemed to harbour an independent life. They padded through the thronging horses as calmly as dogs among sheep. These were the groupards, and they knew very well what the milling mounted folk meant. With little guidance, each cat sought out its mounted master. I watched in stunned surprise as leads were loosed, and each cat leapt nimbly into place. I watched Lady Brisinga turn in her saddle to mutter fond words to her cat, while Sybil's groupard put a heavy paw on his shoulder and pulled the boy back so the cat could bump faces with him. I waited in vain for some manifestation of the wit. I was almost certain both the Brisingas possessed it, but it was controlled to an extent I had not imagined possible. Under the circumstances, no matter how I longed for the touch, I dared not quest out towards Night Eyes. His silence to me was so absolute, it was like an absence. Soon, I promised myself. Soon. We set out for the hills where Avoyne promised us good ground birds and much sport in the taking of them. I rode at the back with the other attendants, breathing dust. Despite the early hour, the day already promised to be unseasonably warm. The fine dust of our passing hung thick in the still air. The soil of the hills was strange stuff, for once the thin surface turf was broken by a trail, the trail became a track of fine, powdery soil. I soon wished for a kerchief to cover my mouth and nose, and the hanging dust discouraged conversation. The hooves of the horses were muffled by the stuff, and with the absence of baying dogs, I felt that we rode in near silence. Soon we left the riverside and the trail behind us, and rode across the face of the sun-drenched hill, through crisping grey-green brush. We wended our way through rolling hills and draws that all looked deceptively alike. The hunters were well ahead of us, and moving steadily when we crested a hill. I think the flock of birds we rousted there surprised even Avoyne, but everyone reacted quickly. I was too far back to see if a signal released the cats, or if the beasts simply reacted to the game. These were large, heavy-bodied birds that ran, wings open and beating before they could lift from the ground. Several never made it into the air, and I saw at least two brought down on the wing by the leaping groupards. The speed of the cats was heart-stopping. They flowed from their cushions, leaping to the ground impactlessly and shooting after the fleeing birds with a speed like a striking snake. One cat actually brought down two birds, seizing one in her jaws even as her clutching paws clasped one to her breast. I had noticed four or five boys on ponies riding behind us. They came forwards now, game bags open to take up the prey. Only one groupard was reluctant to relinquish her kill, and I understood that she was a young hunter, her training still incomplete. The birds were shown to Lord Golden before they were bagged. Siddle, who had been riding beside him, pushed her horse closer to see the trophies and exclaim over them. He took tail feathers from several of the birds, and then summoned me to his side. As I accepted the trophy feathers from him, he instructed me, "Put them in the case right away so they are not marred." "The case?" "The feather case. I showed it to you when we were packing at Buckkeep." "Sars, breath, man, you have not left it behind, have you?" "Ah, well, you shall have to go back for it. You know the one, the tooled red leather with a felted wool lining? It is most likely among my things at Gale Keep, unless you've left it at Buckkeep. Here. Give Huntswoman Laurel the feathers to carry until you return. Make haste now, Tom Badgerlock. I need that case." Lord Golden did not disguise his irritation at his servant's clumsiness. There was indeed such a case amongst Lord Golden's belongings, but he had never told me it was a feather case, nor told me to bring it. I managed to look suitably chastened at my negligence as I bobbed my head to his orders. So simply was I cut free from the hunt. Obedient to my master, I wheeled my horse and touched heels to my black. I put two rolling hills between the hunting party and us before I reached out cautiously to Night Eyes. "I come."
"Better late than never, I suppose," was the grudging reply.
I pulled in my horse and sat still. Wrongness flooded me. I closed my eyes and saw through the wolves. It was a nondescript area, just like every hill and dale I had ridden through that morning. Oak trees in the draws and dusty scrub brush, and yellow grass on the hillsides. But I knew where he was, somehow, and how to get where he was. It was as Night Eyes described it. I knew where I itched before I scratched. I also knew, without his telling me, that there was a reason for his stillness. I quested towards him no more, but simply put heels to my black and leaned forwards to urge her on. She was a runner for level terrain, not these rolling hills, but she did well enough. I soon looked down on the dale where I knew Night Eyes waited. I longed to rush straight down to him. His stillness was as ominous as flies buzzing round blood. I forced myself to cut a wide path around the dale and go slowly, reading the ground and breathing deep for any scents that might linger. I found the tracks of two shod horses, and a moment later cut the same tracks going in the opposite direction. Horses had come and gone from the copse of oak trees, and not long ago. I could restrain myself no longer. I rode into the welcoming shade of the trees, as if I were running my head into a snare. Night Eyes!
Here! Hush!
He lay, panting heavily, in the dry shade of the oaks. Old leaves were stuck to the bloody gashes in his muzzle and flank. I flung myself from my horse and ran to him. I set my hands to his coat, and his thoughts flowed silently into mine in the quietest possible sharing of the wit.
They worked together against me.
The boy and the cat?
I was surprised that he was surprised at that. The boy and the cat were wit-bonded. Of course they would act together.
The cat and the horseman who brought the horses. I was watching the boy up the tree the whole while. I sensed nothing from him, not even that he called to the cat for help. But just after dawn broke, the damned cat attacked me. Dropped right out of a tree onto me, and I hadn't even known she was coming. She must have travelled tree to tree like a squirrel. She clung like a burr. I thought I was winning when I flung her to the ground, but she wrapped her front paws around me and tried to disembowel me with her hind claws. Nearly succeeded, too. Just then the man came up with the horses. The boy climbed down into the saddle, and then, like a flash, the cat was on the horse behind him. They galloped off and left me here.
Let me see your belly.
Water first, before you poke at me.
My black annoyed me by dancing away from me twice before I caught her reins. I tied her securely to a bush after that, and then brought both water and food to Night Eyes. I let him drink from my cupped hands, and then we shared the food between us. I wanted to wash the blood from the gashes I could see, but I knew he wouldn't allow it.
Leave them to close themselves. I've already licked them clean.
At least let me see the ones on your belly. He was not happy about that, but he complied. The damage was much worse there, for the cat had obviously pulled him close, and his belly lacked the thick fur that had somewhat protected his back. They were not clean slashes, but jagged tears that were already festering. The only good aspect was that the claws had not penetrated the wall of his belly. I had feared to see bulging entrails. All I saw was lacerated flesh. I cursed myself for not having any salve to comfort the wounds. It had been too long since I had had to worry about things such as this. I had grown careless in the precautions I took.
Why didn't you call for me to come and help you?
You were too far away to get here in time, and...
Uneasiness tinged his thoughts.
I thought they wanted me to call you. The man on the big horse and the cat. They listened as if my call to you were game they sought to beat out of hiding.
Not the prince?
No. My brother, there is something very strange here. He was surprised when the horseman came with the extra mount. Yet I sensed the cat was not. The cat expected the man and the horses. The prince does not perceive all that his bond partner does. He goes blindly into his bond. It is uneven. One commits, and the other accepts the commitment, but does not return it in full. And the cat is wrong.
He could make it no clearer than that to me. I sat for a time, my fingers buried deep in his coat, pondering what to do next. The prince was gone. Someone he had not summoned had arrived to carry him away from the wolf at precisely the moment that the cat was diverting the wolf. Carry him away to where?
I chased them for a time. But it is as you said, I cannot keep up with a running horse any more.
You never could.
Well, neither could you. You couldn't even keep up with a running wolf for long.
True. That's very true. I smoothed his coat and tried to pluck a dead leaf from one of his scabs.
Leave that alone, I'll bite your hand off.
And he could have. Fast as a snake, he seized my wrist in his jaws. He squeezed it, and then let me go.
It isn't bleeding, so leave it alone. Stop picking at me and go after them.
And do what?
Begin by killing the cat.
It was a vindictive suggestion, with no heart in it. He knew as well as I did what it would do to the prince if we killed his bond animal.
I do. A pity he does not share your scruples about killing your bond brother.
He doesn't know you were bonded to me.
They knew I was bonded to somebody, and would have liked to discover just whom. That knowledge did not dissuade them from hurting me.
I sensed his thoughts racing ahead of mine, pondering a situation I had not deciphered yet.
Be careful, Changer. I recognize this pattern of old. You think this is a game of some kind, with limits and rules. You seek to bring the prince back as a mother carries an errant cub back to the den. You have not even considered that you might have to injure him, or kill the cat to do so. Even farther from your thoughts is that they might kill you to prevent you from taking the prince back. So I change my advice to you. Do not go after them now alone. Give me until this evening to get past my soreness. And when we track them, let us take the scentless one with us. He is clever. In a human sort of way.
Do you think the prince has that in him, to kill me before letting me take him back to Buckkeep? The thought appalled me. Yet I had been younger than Prince Dutiful when I first killed on Chade's orders. I had not especially enjoyed it, but I had not deeply pondered the right or wrong of it. Chade was my conscience then, and I had trusted his discretion. I wondered, was there such a person in the prince's life, someone whose counsel was enough to make him suspend his own judgment?
Stop thinking that you are dealing with a young prince. You are not. Nor is it the cat we must fear. This is something deeper and stranger, my brother, and we are best to go very, very carefully.
He drank the rest of my water. Then I left him there, under the oaks, though I did not like to. I did not attempt to follow their trail, but returned to the Brisinga Manor at Gallatin, found the feather case, and rode back to the hunt. They had moved on, but it was easy enough to track them. When I presented the case to Lord Golden, he observed,
"You were a long time bringing it, Badgerlock."
He looked around at his hunting companions and added,
"Well, at least it is not as I feared. I almost thought you had taken my words to mean that you must bring the case even if you had to go all the way to Buckkeep Castle for it."
There was a general laugh at my supposed dullness. I bobbed my head in docile agreement. "My apologies, Master, for the delay in finding it. It was not where I expected it to be." He accepted my apology with a nod, then handed me the case again.
"Collect the feathers from Hansom and Laurel. See that you put them in carefully."
Laurel had a substantial handful of feathers. The red case opened like a book. Within, the case was lined with felted wool to cushion the feathers against hurts. I held the case while she carefully arranged each feather in its place. The other hunters rode on, seeming to pay no attention to us. "The cats hunt well?" I asked, as she positioned feathers.
"Very well. They are amazing to watch. I had seen the prince's miscat hunt before, but this is my first experience of grouparts. They have set the cats twice on birds and once on hares since you left us."
"Think you they will hunt much longer?"
"I doubt it. Lord Golden confided that the midday sun is too harsh on his skin and may give him a headache. I think they will turn back soon."
That would suit me well also. The others were now a distance away from us, talking amongst themselves. She closed the feather case and handed it back to me. We rode side by side until we caught up with the hunting party. She turned in her saddle to look at me, and met my eyes as she said,
"Last night, Tom Badgerlock, you looked a different man. You should take more care with your daily appearance. The effect is well worth your effort."
Her words left me speechless. She smiled to see me struck dumb, then left me behind with the other attendants as she spurred her horse forward to ride at Lord Golden's stirrup. I do not know what, if any, words passed between them, only that soon the hunting party decided to return to Galekeep. The game bags were heavy, the beat of the sun overhead was becoming oppressive, and the cats seemed irritable and less interested in the hunt. This being so, the nobles turned their horses and set spurs to them, hastening back to the welcome cool of Galekeep's thick stone walls. The rest of us followed as best we might. My black easily kept their pace, though I had to ride in their dust. Nobility retired to their chambers to wash the dust away and don fresh clothing, while others cared for their sweated horses and cranky cats. I followed Lord Golden as he strode ebulliently through the halls. I hastened to open the door for him, and then to shut it behind us after he had passed through. I fastened the latch, quietly. I turned to find him already laving the dust from his face and hands.
"What happened?"
he asked me. I told him.
"Will he be all right?"
he asked anxiously. "The prince? I hardly know."
"Night eyes,"
the fool clarified impatiently. "As well as he may be. I'll take him more water and meat when I return. He was in pain, but not like to die of his injuries." Though I had not liked the look of the inflamed scratches. The fool almost seemed to answer my thoughts. "I have a salve that may soothe his hurts, if he will let you use it." I had to smile. "I doubt that he will, but I will be glad to take it all the same. Well, there but remains for me to manufacture a reason for the three of us to depart Galekeep immediately after lunch. We dare not let his trail go cold, nor do I think it likely that we will be returning here." As he spoke, he was changing his jacket, brushing dust from his trousers and wiping a cloth over his boots. He considered his reflection in the mirror, then hastily ran a brush through his fine hair. The pale strands floated after the brush and clung to it. The shorter pieces at his temples stood out like a cat's whiskers. He exclaimed in annoyance and refastened the heavy silver clip that he used to secure his hair at the base of his neck.
"There, that will have to do. Pack us up, Tom Badgerlock. Be prepared to leave by the time I return from my meal."
And he was gone. There was fruit and cheese and bread on the table from the night before. The bread was a bit stale, but I was hungry enough that it did not matter. I ate as I hastily packed my own things. Lord Golden's wardrobe presented me with more problems. I could not recall how he had fitted so much clothing into such a small bag. At length, I managed to cram it all in, though I wondered what the fine shirts would look like when they emerged again. The midday meal was still in progress when I finished. I took advantage of that and slipped down to the kitchen for cold beer and spicy sausages. My old skills still served me in good stead, for when I left, several thick slices of a cold joint were concealed in the breast of my servant's tunic. I returned to our rooms and spent the early afternoon impatiently awaiting Lord Golden's return. I longed to reach for the wolf, and dared not. Every passing moment might be carrying the prince further away. The afternoon was flowing away from me. I flung myself down onto my bed to wait. Despite my anxiety, I must have dozed off. I awoke to Lord Golden opening the door. I rolled from the bed to my feet, feeling sodden with sleep, yet eager to leave. He shut the door behind me, and in response to my look, replied grimly, "It is proving socially difficult to extricate us. There were guests at today's luncheon, and not just those we hunted with. The Brisingas seemed determined to exhibit me to all their wealthy neighbours. They have planned dinners and teas and more hunts with half the countryside in attendance. I have been unable to invent a pressing enough reason for us to leave. This is damnably inconvenient. Would that I could go back to my motley and a more honest form of juggling and rope-walking." "We're not leaving yet," I observed stupidly. "No. There is a large dinner in my honour this evening. For us to abruptly leave before that would be an insult. And when I hinted that I might have to cut my visit short and leave tomorrow morning, I was told that Lord Cryus from across the river had planned a morning hunt for me, and an afternoon repast at his manor." "They delay you on purpose. The Brisingas are involved in the prince's disappearance. I am sure they provided food for him and the cat last night. And Night Eyes is certain that those who attacked him are aware he is bonded to someone. They tried to flush me out."
"Perhaps, but even if we were certain, I could scarcely fling accusations about.
and we are not certain. Perhaps they but seek social advancement at court, or to show me their various marriageable daughters. I gather that is why the girl was at dinner last night. I thought she was Sybil's companion. She was at great pains during the hunt to tell me they were childhood friends with absolutely no romantic interests in one another. He sighed and sat down at the small table. She told me that she, too, collects feathers. Tonight, after dinner, she wishes to show me her collection. I am certain it is an invention to spend more time with me. Had my own deeds not been so pressing, I would have smiled at his dismay. Well, I shall have to deal with it as best I may, and perhaps it can even be turned to our advantage now that I think of it. Oh, I've an errand for you. It seems that while we were hunting today, I lost a silver chain. At lunch I noticed it was missing. It is one of my favourites. You will have to retrace our steps and see if you can find it. Take your time. As he spoke, he drew a necklace from his pocket, wrapped it in his kerchief and handed it to me. I pocketed it. He opened his clothing case, shot me an accusing look at the compressed jumble inside it, and then fished about until he discovered the pot of salve. He handed it to me. "Shall I lay out your clothing for dinner before I go?" He rolled his eyes mockingly at me as he drew a crumpled shirt from his clothing bag. "I think you've already done enough for me, Badgerlock. Just go." As I moved towards the door, his voice stopped me. "Does the horse suit you?" "The black is fine," I assured him. "A good, healthy beast and fleet, as we proved. You chose a good horse. But you would rather have chosen your own mount." I nearly said yes, but then, as I considered it, I realized that was not true. If I had been choosing the horse, I would have sought for a companion to bear me through the years. It would have taken me weeks, if not months, to select one. And now that I was unwillingly confronting the wolf's mortality, I felt a strange reluctance to offer that much of myself to an animal. "No," I replied honestly. "It was much better that you chose one for me. She's a good horse. You chose well." "Thank you," he said quietly. It seemed to matter to him a great deal. If the wolf had not been waiting, it would have given me pause. Chapter 18. Fool's Kiss. Many are the tales told of witted taking on their beasts' shapes to wreak havoc upon their neighbours. The bloodier legends are of witted in wolves' skins, who in that guise rend their neighbours' families as well as their flocks. Less sanguine are the tales who depict witted suitors taking on the shapes of birds, or cats, or even dancing bears to gain access to a bedchamber in the course of a seduction. All such tales are imaginative nonsense, perpetuated by those who seek to fuel hatred of the witted. Although a witted person can share the mind of his beast, and hence its physical perceptions, he cannot metamorphose his human form into that of an animal. It is true that some witted, who have been long in a partnership with their animals, sometimes take on some of their habits of posture, diet, and mannerism. But a man who eats, dens, scavenges, and smells like a bear does not become a bear. If that myth of shape-changing could be vanquished, it would go far to re-establishing trust between the witted and unwitted. Badgerlock's Old Blood Tales. The wolf was not where I had left him. It rattled me, and I took some few moments convincing myself that I had not mistaken the spot. But there were the spatters of his blood where he had sprawled on last year's leaves, and here were the spatters in the dust where he had lapped water from my hands. He had been here, and now he was not. It is one thing to track two shod horses with riders. It is another to follow the spoor of a wolf over dry ground. He had left no trace of his passage, and I feared to reach out towards him. I followed the tracks of the horses, believing that he would have done the same. As I trailed them through the sun-drenched hills, their tracks went down into a draw and crossed a small stream. They had stopped here to let the horses water. And then, in the muddy bank, was a wolf's paw print atop the horse's hoof mark. So, he was tracking them. Three hills later, I caught up with him. He knew I was coming. He did not pause to wait for me, but moved on. That gait caught my eyes. It was not his purposeful trot. He walked. My black was not especially pleased to approach the wolf, but she didn't fight me. As I drew closer, he stopped in the shelter of some trees and awaited me. "I brought meat," I told him as I dismounted. I felt his awareness of me, but he sent no thoughts towards me. It was eerie. I took the meat out of my shirt and gave it to him. He wolfed it down and then came to sit beside me. I took the salve out of my pouch. He sighed and lay down. The claw swipes along his belly were livid ridges of lacerated flesh and hot to the touch. When I applied the salve, the pain became an edged thing between us. I was as gentle as I could be and still be thorough. He tolerated it, but not gladly. I sat for a time beside him, my hand resting on his ruff. He sniffed at the salve I had applied. "Honey and bear grease," I told him. He licked the long scratch and I let him. His tongue would push the ointment deeper into the wound and do him no harm. Besides, there was no way I could have stopped him. He already knew that I would have to go back to Gale Keep.
"It would be wisest for me to keep following them, even if I don't go swiftly. The longer you are delayed, the colder the trail will be. Easier for you to come to me than to try to follow fading tracks."
There is no arguing with that. I gave no voice to my worries that he could neither hunt nor defend himself just now. He knew it. I knew it. And he had made his decision. "I'll catch up with you as soon as I can." He knew that too, but I could not refrain from the promise.
"My brother, be careful what you dream tonight."
"I won't seek to dream with them."
"I fear they may seek you."
Fear smoked through my mind, but again there was nothing to say. I wished, vainly, that I had been brought up knowing more of the wit. Perhaps if I had understood old blood better, I would know what I was dealing with now.
"No, I think not. What you do, how you link to him, that is not just skill. It is the crossing of your magic. You open the door with one and travel with the other. As when I attacked Justin after he had bridged into you with skill. His skill made the bridge, but I use my bond with you to run across it."
He had deliberately shared that thought with me, acknowledging a worry that had been growing in me for some time. Dog magic, Justin had called my wit, and told me that my use of the skills stank of it. Verity had never complained of that, but Verity, I admitted unwillingly, shared my truncated education in the skill. Perhaps he had not detected a staining of the wit in my use of the skill, or perhaps he had been too kind to ever rebuke me with it. Now I worried for my wolf. "Do not follow them too closely. Try not to let them know that we track them."
"What did you fear? That I would attack a cat and two men on horseback? No, that battle belongs to you. I will trail this game. It is up to you to bring it to bay and down it."
His thought created unpleasant images in my mind all the way back to Gale Keep. I had entered into this to track down a boy, run away or perhaps kidnapped. Now I was facing not only a boy who did not wish to be returned to Buckkeep, but his confederates. How far would I go in my efforts to return him to the Queen, and what limits would he set in his determination to have his own way? Would those with him have any constraints as to what they would do to keep him? I knew Lord Golden was wise to continue our play. Much as I longed to drop all pretense and simply hunt down the prince and drag him back to Buckkeep, I could see the consequences of that. If the Brisingas were certain that we pursued him, they would certainly get a warning to him. He would flee faster and hide deeper. Worse, they might directly interfere with our pursuit of him. I had no wish to meet with an untimely accident as we tracked Prince Dutiful. As matters stood, we could still hope to move secretly to regain the prince and discreetly convey him back to Buckkeep. He had fled Gale Keep at our arrival, yet not gone far at first. Now he was on the move again, but still had no reason to connect Lord Golden to any pursuit. If the fool could pry us loose of Lady Brisinga's hospitality without arousing any suspicion, we could follow him unobtrusively and have a better chance of catching up with him. I returned to Gale Keep hot and dusty and parched. It still seemed odd to surrender my horse to a stableman. I found Lord Golden napping in his chambers. The curtains were drawn against the heat and light, putting the room in twilight. I went quietly past him to my own room to wash most of the dust and sweat away. I hung my shirt on the bedpost to dry and air, and slung my fresh one over my shoulder. Servants had replenished the bowl of fruit in Lord Golden's chamber. I helped myself to a plum and ate it by the window, peering around the curtain at the garden outside. I felt both tired and restless. I could think of nothing constructive to do and no way to pass the time. Frustration and worry chafed me.
"Did you find my chain, Badgerlock?"
It was Lord Golden's aristocratic tone that interrupted my thought.
Yes, my lord, just where you thought you'd lost it.
I drew the delicate jewelry from my pocket and carried it over to where he lounged on his bed. He accepted it as gratefully as if he were truly a nobleman and it had truly been lost. I lowered my voice.
Night Eyes follows the trail for us. When we can leave, we can go straight to the wolf.
How is he?
Stiff, sore. But I think he will recover.
Excellent.
He sat up and swung his legs over the side of the bed. I've selected evening clothing for us and laid it out in your room.
Really, Badgerlock, you must learn to handle my garments more carefully.
I'll try, my lord, I muttered, but I could not get my heart back into the game. I was suddenly tired of the whole charade. Have you thought of a way for us to leave discreetly?
No.
He strolled to the table. Wine had been left there for him. He poured a glass and drank it, then poured another.
But I've thought of an indiscreet one and already laid the groundwork for it this afternoon. Not without regrets. I'll be compromising Lord Golden's reputation somewhat. But what is a nobleman without a bit of scandal to his name? It will probably just increase my popularity at court. Everyone will want to know my side of it and will speculate on what truly happened.
He sipped from his glass.
I think that if I succeed at this, it will convince Lady Brisinga that her fears we are seeking the prince are groundless. No proper emissary of the queen would behave as I intend.
He gave me a sickly smile.
What have you done?
Nothing, just yet.
But I fancy that by morning our leaving will be facilitated as swiftly as we could wish.
He drank again.
Sometimes I don't care for the things I must do,
he observed, and there was a plaintive note in his voice. He finished the glass of wine as if girding himself for a task. Not another word would he divulge to me. He arrayed himself carefully for dinner, and I had to suffer the indignity of the green jerkin and yellow leggings.
Perhaps it is a shade too bright,
he conceded in response to my incensed gaze. His grin was too broad for me to believe any apology in his words. I did not know if it was the wine or one of his fey humours.
"Stop glowering, Badgerlock,"
he rebuked me as he adjusted the cuffs of a muted green coat.
"I expect my servants to maintain a pleasant demeanour. Besides, the colour does set off the darkness of your eyes and skin and hair, all of you. It rather reminds me of an exotic parrot."
You may not appreciate such a show of yourself, but the ladies will.
Obeying him taxed all my ability to dissemble. I walked behind him to where the nobility had gathered before dinner. This was a larger group than the night before, for Lady Brisinga had extended her hospitality to those who had hunted with her earlier. They might have been invisible for all the notice Lord Golden gave them. Siddal was seated at a low table with young Civil. An assortment of feathers was spread out before her on a cloth, and they seemed to be discussing them. She had obviously been watching the door, for the moment Lord Golden entered, her face was transfigured. She gleamed like a lantern in the darkness. Young Civil also underwent a transformation, but it was not so pleasant. He could not very well sneer at a guest in his mother's house, but his features went very still and cold. Dismay clutched at my belly. No, I wanted no part of this. But Golden, smiling and charming, made directly for the pair. His greetings to everyone else in the chamber were brief to the point of neglect. Without even a pretense of subtlety, he seated himself between them, obliging Civil to move over to make room for him. From that moment on, he virtually ignored everyone else in the room as he focused all of his allure on the girl. Their heads bent together over the feathers. His every movement was a seduction. His long fingers stroked the gaudy feathers on the cloth. He selected one and touched its softness to his own cheek, and then leaned forwards to draw it gently down the length of Siddal's arm.
She giggled nervously and drew back from the touch. He smiled. She blushed. He set the feather back on the cloth and shook a reproachful finger at it as if it were at fault. Then he selected another one. Boldly, he held it against the sleeve of her gown, murmuring some comparison of colour. He gathered others from the cloth, arranged them in a sort of feather bouquet. With the tip of one forefinger, he turned her face to look at his, and then, by a trick I could not see, fastened the feathers into her hair so that they hung down and followed the line of her cheek. Sybil rose abruptly and stalked away. His mother spoke to a woman at her side, who moved swiftly to intercept him before he left the chamber. There were low-voiced words between them, and the young man's tone was not calm. I could not follow what he said, for Lord Golden's words rose over the general conversation to proclaim,
"Would that I had a looking-glass to show you, but you must be content to see how well this ornament becomes you by looking into my eyes."
Earlier that day I had been appalled at how brazenly she had stalked Lord Golden, and how willing she had been to throw over her young suitor for the strange nobleman. Now, I almost pitied Sybil. One hears of birds charmed by snakes, though I have never seen such a thing. What I witnessed now was more like a flower leaning towards light. She absorbed his attention and blossomed in its warmth. In the space of a few moments, her girlish infatuation with his age and wealth and fine ways had been transformed into a more womanly warmth and fascination with him. I knew with crawling certainty that she was his to bed, if he chose. Should he tap at her chamber door tonight, she would admit him without hesitation.
"He goes too far."
Laurel's breathless whisper was tinged with horror as she strolled past me. "He excels at that," I murmured in reply. I shifted my shoulders in the confines of my gaudy jacket. My pretense at being Lord Golden's bodyguard might become real tonight. Certainly the look Sybil shot him promised murder. When Lady Brisinga announced that it was time to dine, Sybil made the foolish mistake of hesitating. Before he had even the chance churlishly to refuse to escort Sybil to the table, his rival had offered his arm, and the girl had taken it. This left Sybil duty-bound to escort his slighted mother as they followed their esteemed guest and his prey into the dining hall. I tried to rein my emotions in and be a stoic observer of that dinner. Lord Golden's tactic revealed much to me. Sybil's parents were obviously torn between courtesy to Lady Brisinga and her son, and the enticing prospect of their daughter winning the attention of this extremely wealthy nobleman. Lord Golden was a far more desirable catch than young Sybil, yet they were not unmindful of the danger to their young daughter. To catch a nobleman's eye is not the same as to have the pledge of one. There was a danger that he might toy with her and ruin her for future marriage. It was a dangerous line for a young girl to walk, and in the way that Lady Grayling picked her bread to pieces, I plainly saw her mother's doubts that Sybil could toe it. Avoyne and Laurel tried desperately to kindle a conversation about the day's hunt, and the talk lurched along, but Lord Golden and Sybil were too deeply engrossed in their own quiet talk to pay any attention. Sybil, seated to the other side of Sybil, was ignored by both of them. Avoyne was holding forth on the uses of roux in training cats, for all knew that a cat would avoid anything marked with the essence of the herb. Laurel said that onion was sometimes used for the same purpose. Lord Golden offered Sybil a titbit from his plate, and then stared in rapt fascination as the girl ate it. He was drinking heavily tonight, glass after glass, and to all appearances he was actually pouring it all down his throat. I felt anxiety. The fool, drunk, had always been both unpredictable and volatile. Would Lord Golden have more restraint when in his cups? Sybil's anger must have flared, for I felt a querying wit echo from something. I could not catch the thought, only the emotion that accompanied it. Something was fully willing to rend Lord Golden to shreds on Sybil's behalf. I did not doubt that his hunting cat was his witbeast. For that unguarded moment of fury, the connection between them sang with bloodlust. It was quenched in an instant, but there was no mistaking what it was. The boy was witted. And Lady Brisinga? I looked past her, watching her without seeming to. I felt no trace of the wit from her, but she radiated maternal disapproval of her son's lapse. Because he had betrayed his old blood to any who might be aware of such things? Or because his displeasure showed so plainly on his face? Betraying one's emotions so blatantly was not genteel. I stood, as I had the previous night, behind Lord Golden's chair all through the meal. I learned little from the words exchanged that night, but much from the glances. Lord Golden's scandalous behaviour both fascinated and horrified the other guests. Quiet words were exchanged, as were shocked glances. Lord Grayling at one point sat breathing through his white, pinched nostrils for several moments, while his wife spoke frantically to him in an undertone. She appeared willing to gamble the Brisinga's goodwill for the possible benefit of a better match. Through all this interplay, I sifted expressions and exchanges, looking for some sign of who was witted. It was not information I could quantify, but before the dinner was over I was satisfied that both Sybil and Lady Brisinga were. I was equally certain their huntsman was not. Of the other guests at their table, there were two I suspected of the wit. A certain Lady Gerrit had something of the cat in her mannerisms. She was perhaps unaware of how she breathed in the scent of every dish before she ventured to taste it. Her spouse, a hale and hearty man, had a trick of turning his head sideways to the leg of fowl he was devouring, as if he had sharper teeth there with which to scissor the meat free. Small habits, but telling. As the prince had fled Buckkeep to Galekeep, so he might, when driven from Galekeep, go to another wit-friendly holding. These two lived to the south. The prince's trail led north. But that did not mean he would not circle back. I noticed another thing as well. Lady Brisinga's eyes came often to settle on me, and I did not think she was admiring my gaudy garments. She looked like a woman trying to recall something. I was almost certain I had never met her in my other life as Fitzchivalry, but to be almost certain of something means there is always a squirming of doubt in the back of the mind. For a time, I kept my head slightly lowered and my eyes cast to one side. Only after I observed the others did I realize what a wolf-like attitude that was. When next she looked at me, I met her eyes boldly and stared back. I was not so bold as to smile at her, but I deliberately widened my eyes, feigning an interest in her. Her affront at Lord Golden's bold servant was plain. Cat-like, she unfocused her eyes and looked through me. In that glance I was finally sure of her. Old blood. I wondered if she was the woman that had captivated my prince's fancy. Certainly she was attractive. Her full lips hinted at sensuality. Dutiful would not be the first young man to fall victim to a knowledgeable older woman. Had that been her aim in giving the cat to him? To seduce him and win his young heart, so that no matter where he was wed, she would always keep his heart. It would explain why he had come here when he had fled Buckkeep. But, I reflected, it would not explain his unfulfilled passion. No, if she had intended to seduce the prince, she would have moved swiftly to entangle him as deeply as possible. There was something else here, something strange, as the wolf had said. A brief flip of Lord Golden's hand at the end of the meal dismissed me. I went, but reluctantly. I wanted to witness whatever reactions his abominable behaviour might bring. The diners would move on to other amusements now, music, games of chance, and conversation. I went to the kitchen, and again was offered a choice of the feast's remains. There had been a piglet tonight, cooked whole, and plenty of tender meat and crisp skin lay scattered among the bones on the platter. A sauce of sour apples and berries had accompanied it. This, with bread and soft white cheese and several mugs of ale, made a more than adequate meal. It might have been more enjoyable if Lord Golden's man had not been taken to task over his master's behaviour. Sybil and Sybil, I was informed sternly by Lebvin, had been affianced almost from birth. Well, if not formally, at least it was common knowledge among all the folk of both households that the two were intended for one another. His mother's house and Lord Grayling's family had always been on the best of terms, and the two estates were adjacent to one another. Why should not Grayling's daughter benefit from Lady Brisinga's rapid rise in the world? Old friends should help one another. What was my master thinking to come between them? Could his intentions be honourable? Would he steal young Sybil's bride from him to bear her off to court and wealth beyond her station? Did he womanise at Buckkeep? Was he but toying with her affections? Was he good with a sword? for it was well known that Civil had a temper, and hospitality or no, the boy might challenge him over Siddle. To all of this I professed ignorance. I was newly come to Lord Golden's service, and to the court at Buckkeep. I knew little of my master's ways or temperament yet. I was as curious as they were as to what would befall them all. The excitement that Golden had stirred was such that I could not steer the conversation to dutiful, or old blood, or any useful topic. I lingered only long enough to purloin a large chunk of meat. Then I pleaded my duties and departed the kitchen for my room, frustrated of knowledge and deeply concerned for Lord Golden's welfare. As soon as I was back in our rooms, I changed back into my humbler blue clothing. The green jerkin had rather suffered from concealing the meat. Then I sat down to await my master's return. Anxiety roiled through me. If he carried this role too far, he might indeed find himself facing young Civil's blade. I doubted that Lord Golden was any better with a sword than the fool had been. It would, of course, be scandalous if it came to bloodshed. But young men in Civil's position were not inclined to worry about such niceties. The depths of the night had passed, and we were venturing towards the shallows of dawn, when there was a tap at the door. A dour-faced maid informed me that my master required my assistance. Heart in mouth, I followed her to discover Lord Golden senseless with drink on a bench in a parlour. He sprawled there like a cast-off garment. If other folk had witnessed his collapse, they had left. Even the maid gave a small toss of her head as she abandoned me to tend to him. As soon as she left, I half expected him to rouse and tip me a wink that this was all a sham. He did not. I hauled him to his feet, but even that did not stir him. I could either drag him or carry him. I resorted to the undignified expediency of slinging him over my shoulder and toting him back to his chamber like a sack of grain. I dumped him unceremoniously onto the bed and fastened the door behind us. Then I dragged off his boots and shook him out of his jacket. As he fell back onto the bed, he said, "Well, I did it. I'm certain of it. I'll apologize tomorrow most abjectly to Lady Brisinga. Then we'll leave immediately. And all will be relieved to see us go. No one will follow us. No one will suspect we track the prince." His voice wavered towards the end of this speech. He still had not opened his eyes. Then, in a strained voice, he added, "I think I'm going to vomit." I brought him the washbasin and set it on the bed next to him. He crooked an arm around it as if it were a doll. "What exactly did you do?" I demanded. "Oh, Ada, make it all stand still." He clenched his eyes tightly and spoke. "I kissed him. I knew that would do it."
"You kissed Siddle, Civil's intended?"
"No," he groaned, and I knew a short-lived moment of relief. "I kissed Civil."
"What?"
"I had gone to piss. When I came back, he was waiting for me outside the parlour where the others were gaming. He grabbed my arm and all but dragged me into a sitting room where he confronted me. What were my intentions towards Siddle? Did I not grasp that they had an understanding?"
"What did you say?"
"I said..." He paused abruptly, and his eyes grew round. He leaned towards the basin. But after a moment he only burped gassily and lay back. He groaned, and then continued, "I said I understood their understanding, and hoped that perhaps we could come to an understanding of our own. I clasped his hand in mine. I said I saw no difficulty. And Siddle was a lovely girl, as lovely a girl as he was a boy, and that I hoped we might all become close and loving friends."
"And then you kissed him?"
I was incredulous. Lord Golden screwed his eyes shut. "He seemed a bit naive. I wanted to be sure he took the fullness of my meaning."
"Ada and Elle in a tangle," I swore.
I stood up and he groaned as the bed moved beneath him. I walked to the window and stared out.
"How could you?"
I demanded of him. He took a breath and strained mockery crept into his face.
"Oh, please, beloved. You needn't be jealous. It was the most brief and chaste kiss you can imagine."
"Oh, fool," I rebuked him.
How could he make a jest of something like this?
It wasn't even on the mouth, just a warm press of my lips to the palm of his hand. A single flick of my tongue.
He smiled feebly.
He snatched it away as if I'd branded him.
Suddenly he hiccuped loudly, and then made a sound.